A very warm welcome. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost with you every weekday from 9 until 1 on consuming issues on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are back in the studio for our weekly catch-up, talking through the stories they've been tackling this week. And today, I'm joined by Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Lee Boyce. On the agenda today, got a gripe with a high street shop, perhaps a faulty car repair, or even a bit of shoddy workmanship? Well, now we have a louder voice for our complaints.
We take on the problem, we look at it, we go back to the company, get the details from there, we make a decision. If there needs to be some sort of remedy, we will recommend what that remedy should be.
We'll be taking a closer look at the new Consumer Ombudsman service. Also, one thing that's really gotten our wicks this week, and that's the airport shops that have been pocketing VAT savings meant for us.
I just assumed it was obligatory and it was a legal requirement. Didn't ask any other questions.
Well, I feel, very ripped off. The audacity, I can't believe they've been doing it for so many years.
Will you join the thousands in refusing to show your boarding pass? We also uncover a brand new mis-selling scandal that could see bank customers pocket a £33 billion windfall. So what did the banks do wrong this time? And will you receive compensation? Talking of mis-selling, we take a closer look at the impact that it can cause, with one couple facing losing their home. Also, an investigation straight out of a Michael Lewis book.
The anxious days and weeks through which we have all passed are over. The great adventure has begun.
How a shadowy high-tech trader's using a World War II radio mast to cream billions off our pensions. And we're asking today, a broken heart apparently isn't the only thing that you need to worry about when you finish with your partner, or they finish with you indeed. The average British person is left with nearly £500 of debt on a shared credit card and over £300 in joint account fees. That's according to the latest figures. A third also saw their credit rating suffer because of joint financial commitments with their ex.
It's not the sexiest thing to talk about as you're a new couple and you're engaging in a relationship and you're talking about maybe doing your shared finances. When we spoke to people, one in five had no idea about their partner's financial history before getting a shared account.
So I thought, what's the simplest thing you can talk about in terms of finance with your partner? And that is how much you get paid. So I want to know, not how much you get paid, you don't have to tell me that, but have you told your partner how much you get paid? And if so, when in a relationship, do you think it's appropriate to do so? If you do indeed. A very good morning, Rachel. A very good morning, Lee.
Morning.
Rachel, let's start with you.
I think as soon as your finances start to get mingled, then it makes sense to start talking about it. So perhaps not first date, but as soon as, certainly if you're talking about sort of joint financial products, living together. But then even things like holidays, you might want to sort of, once you start talking about what your budgets are, type of places that you both might want to stay, then that might create an opportunity to start talking about it.
Have you ever had that conversation with a partner?
Yeah, I'm rubbish at all that kind of stuff. I'm really not good about talking about money, but I must get better in all walks of life.
I said the same thing. I've never had that conversation with a partner. And isn't it weird? We both work in finance and we talk about it every day. And yet, can we talk about it in relationships? No, we cannot. Lee, yourself?
Yeah, I agree with Rachel. It gets to a point where you kind of have to sort of reveal what you're earning, really, because if you're getting a mortgage and that sort of stuff, you're going to have all of the forms, everything that needs to be filled out. So you're going to, find out how much each other earns. But, if you're a rich banker or something in the city, maybe you want to sort of squeeze it in that first date. If you're looking to impress, I mean, who knows?
Squeeze it in that first date.
We're going through it all at the moment, with girlfriend and I. So you have to be really sort of open and honest. And it's not just how much you're earning, but how much debt you've got. And if you've got more debt than your partner, it is almost like, oh. But you've just got to be open and honest, I think. Yeah, we're talking a couple of years down the line, I would say. Depending on how fast your relationship moves, I guess. But that's, how I found it this time around. So
I was wondering if it's a cultural thing, as whether we British just don't like talking about it. We've spoken to people from Greece, from Israel, from Denmark, from Ireland today. And a lot of those just say, no, we're just straight off the bat. No problems about it.
I don't really have any problems with it, really. It doesn't really, it's just a...
Maybe it's just me.
To celebrate Share Radio's first year, we're giving away a Pure Evoke D2 digital radio every single week. Many lucky winners have already received theirs, and you could be next. To enter, visit shareradio.co.uk, register your details, and you'll be entered into the weekly draw. Open to UK residents over the age of 16. Visit our website for full terms and conditions. Share Radio, sharing ideas about money.
You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost, here with you until 1 o'clock this afternoon on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio for our weekly catch-up. In the studio with me, Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Lee Boyce. And coming up, tut-tut for airport shops pocketing VAT savings that are meant for us. But first, complaining. It seems we're doing it more than ever. 66 million complaints were made last year, or one every 2 seconds. But how many of these ended in success for us, the consumer? Well, that might soon change, as now we're getting extra muscle for our gripes with high street shops, faulty car repairs and shoddy workmanship. We now have a new free ombudsman service. So here's Lewis Shand-Smith from the service. He spoke to us earlier.
It provides for the first time an easy access, an easy route to justice for where people have gone had a complaint where something's gone wrong. They've bought something, they've paid money for a service, they're not receiving the service, something's gone wrong with the thing they've bought. And instead of having to go to the courts to get redress, they can now come through our scheme. So basically, what we do is we take on the problem, we look at it, we go back to the company, get the details from there, we make a decision, and then we decide if there needs to be some sort of remedy, we will recommend what that remedy should be.
So great news, right? Well, yes, if the firm about which you are complaining has signed up. It is a voluntary scheme. So tell us a little bit more about this. Why was it set up?
Well, there's ways of getting redress in some areas of sort of purchases and services, but there's this been a big gap for a long time for things that go wrong, dodgy workmanship that you're not happy with. You can complain to them. You can get in touch with us at thisismoney.co.uk. We love helping out readers. But if you reach deadlock, then up until now, a lot of the time, you have to go to the small claims court if you want to take your complaint further, which is really more effort than most people want to go to. And so then companies get let off the hook. This is, in theory, a much simpler form of recourse for people when things go wrong. How well it works remains to be seen, since you don't have to sign up for it. And
you don't know how many people have signed up already, is that right? You've investigated that.
I think that's the real sort of crux of the issue here, is that it sounds like, as Rachel says, a good idea sort of on paper, but you know, we've asked how many firms have signed up to it, and they've actually said they have no shareable figures at the moment, which is just a way of saying probably not very many, which is going to be a bit of a shame if not many do, because it's a voluntary scheme. So, you know, is it going to be in firms' best interest to sign up to this scheme? Well,
and you don't know if the firm you're complaining about has signed up. So you go through all the rigmarole of going through the complaints procedure, if only to be told, actually, no, they've not signed up to this.
Precisely. So, you know, it's one of these things that I'd like it to work, and it'd be really good if we're sitting here this time next year and customers are getting their money back after using this ombudsman service. But, you know, at the same time, a company's got sort of about 2 months to sort out your gripe. And I would suggest that on the whole, most will. So this is going to be for the real sort of serious nitty-gritty cases. But if that firm isn't signed up to it, then there's nothing else you could do. It's going to be interesting if they're going to publish a list of firms by the end of the year, because if they don't, it's almost a bit pointless,
in my opinion. This is all very new, so maybe give them a little bit of bedding in time. But Rachel?
Well, so you wonder who are the companies who are going to sign up. I mean, I would imagine that there would be those who are most likely to take customer services
seriously
in the first place.
Absolutely. So say it does work and they do sign up, etc., etc. What powers does this new consumer ombudsman have?
Well, they can legally make companies, you know, if they rule in favour of the customer, companies will be legally binding on that outcome. So they'd have to offer the compensation that the ombudsman says. So that's good. That gives the ombudsman, you know, plenty of teeth. But I still, I just don't know if this is going to work properly.
Now, I mentioned this is all comes as it's emerged that we're complaining more than ever. I mean, I said there, 66 million complaints made last year, one every 2 seconds. Well, earlier we spoke to consumer psychologist Dr. Paul Marsden, who helped conduct the research about why this is on the up.
There were 66 million complaints in the UK last year, which was more than we were expecting, because that's actually one complaint for every second of every day. Perhaps more interesting, though, is that it's how we're complaining now. And it's a technology thing. A third of us now are complaining, making our complaints via social media. And that's interesting because what social media has done is made it very easy and quick for us to complain. And psychologically, there's a lot less anxiety inducing rather than facing down somebody in person. And so it makes it just easier and faster and less anxiety for us to complain. And so we end up complaining more.
So are we just being more moany, do you think, or is it a sign we are better clued up about our consumer rights?
It's just so much easier to make a big noise now, I think, than it was. And the more people who make noise, the more people realise that you don't have to put up with bad customer service. You can get angry. Also, I think there's a kind of... it's a bit of a social thing as well. I think people don't like to cause a fuss, particularly if they're with other people. You know, if you're having a nice dinner and the wrong dish turns up or you're not happy with it, it's cold. And lots of people will just sort of stomach it. But as more people start vocalising their complaints, then perhaps that becomes more normalised.
What do you hear on your website are the biggest gripes?
A lot of them are about energy firms. You know, you get a lot of people that, you know, are not getting the correct bills or not getting charged correctly, get a lot of banking issues. Some of them could be very complex and take a lot of investigating. We get a real wide range of complaints that you could never dream of. And I sort of think to myself, well, actually, some of these complaints departments and some of these firms, it must be quite a difficult job sometimes, yeah. Having to, if it's not your, you know, it's not your fault, your customer services representative, you're representing the company, but of course things have gone wrong behind the scenes with systems and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. And the thing is now, firms really don't have anywhere to hide in the fact that social media, Twitter, you know, a lot of these companies now have Twitter accounts where people just sort of, you know, just laying complaints at their door instantly rather than having to write a letter, send it off, which probably would have put people off in the past, or even phoning up probably put people off. People actually don't like confrontation very much and would rather do it in a sort of written format. And that's where, you know, the internet really has been the rise of it. And also it's just a lot more competition in certain industries now. So if you're fed up with a certain service or a certain product, more often than not, you can go somewhere else after your complaint's been dealt with and people are voting with their feet.
Well, you mentioned their energy firms. Well, spare a thought for those who work in the complaints department of Npower. Why? Because the bad news continues for Britain's energy companies. Npower losing 300,000 customers and profits taking a nosedive by 65% because of their dodgy billing system. What's worse is they say it may not be fixed until 2017. Some customers have been getting multiple bills and others, well, no bills at all, and the problems are under scrutiny by the energy watchdog Ofgem, and it's likely they'll receive hefty fines. They were the most complained about energy company in Britain last year. So, Rachel, take us right back, if you would. When did things start to go wrong for Npower? We're talking about the billing system here.
I think it was late 2013 that they changed their billing system. They tried to upgrade it. And we saw what we've seen now with, I think, at least five of the big six now. When they've upgraded their systems, it just goes terribly wrong. And people end up falling through the cracks, not getting bills for a long time. And then suddenly they'll get three. And Npower is definitely still in the midst of this now. I spent a day with their customer service team, sort of listening in on complaints and things a few months ago.
What was that like?
It's a tough gig, that one, trying to field those calls. And they definitely are, I mean, I got the impression that they are committed to turning things round. But I think that what people find so frustrating, not just with Npower, but making complaints in general, when something goes wrong, you just want to be able to phone up someone and they fix it. And if they can't do it straight away, then they phone you back, they tell you how things are progressing and ultimately it gets done. And if that happens, you, as a company, you can turn around what is a very negative experience for a customer into really something that can be positive. I mean, you can really win loyalty if you just sort out a problem, maybe a little bit of compensation, whatever it takes to make them happy again. That can turn into a positive experience. But what Npower has been doing with customers for the last few months is not phoning people back and letting complaints drag on and on. People get so frustrated that they have to phone up Npower every week to hear the progress on their case. They are trialling a new system at the moment whereby every customer with an outstanding complaint will be allocated one member of staff who they know what their direct number is, how to contact them, and they can leave them messages. I mean, this sounds like how things should be done, that they consider this to be particularly revolutionary is perhaps indicative of just how badly wrong things have been going so far. But if they can roll that out, I mean, I asked them about this because I think that sounds a lot more expensive, right? If you can't just have a group of people on the phone who answer calls, sort of, you know, feel things as they come up, if you have to have a system whereby you can contact people individually. But they said actually it ends up being more cost effective because you don't have people phoning up all the time finding out what's going on, which takes up more man hours. If you have everything working as clockwork, things get done very quickly, then it's much better.
But so bad, though, I'm talking about this billing system, so bad was it, they were ordered to give power away for free last month to disgruntled customers. Now, to their credit, NPower boss Paul Massara does say that already this year we've made real improvements for our customers, halving the number of complaints that we receive, meaning complaints are at their lowest levels since 2011. But really bad news if you look at all this for NPower.
Yeah, I actually written a story yesterday and I crunched through the figures of the complaints it receives. In the first half of this year, complaints are actually down, but when I say they're down, in the first 6 months of last year, they had over 800,000 complaints, which is an absolutely astronomical amount of complaints. And this year, it was something like 450,000.
Is there any other company in any other industry that you've seen that many complaints?
No, I'm not sure there is. Maybe there is, but
I think actually that NPower is very pleased with themselves because they're actually fifth out of the six big six energy companies for complaints. This is not because they've improved necessarily, although they have slightly, as Lee says, but Scottish Power has got so much worse. And for precisely the same reason that NPower has experienced, they've transitioned over to this new billing system and it all goes wrong again. NPower set a target, Paul Massara set a target when he took over as chief exec in 2013, that it would be the number one energy supplier for customer service. I think he set a target of, was it the end of this year? He set it this year, and I asked him, could he please, since that wasn't really looking realistic, could he please let me know what his new target was? And he no longer is into time-specific targets for being number one. Things are taking a little bit longer than they hoped.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, but over 300,000 customers leaving, Lee.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite crazy. And you were talking about they had to give free electricity last month, and that was because some of the complaints were taking far too long to resolve. And 300,000 customers, it does sound like a hell of a lot. But then you think to yourself, there's six big energy firms in Britain. Mm-hmm. They each must have a fair few million. So I don't know, they're not going to reveal how many exactly that they've got. But I mean, that, even 300,000 to me, it sounds like a real mass exodus. And I wonder if people are starting to switch to smaller providers that might be offering better customer service.
Are we seeing that? Are we seeing people?
We are. I know we spoke a couple of months ago about a lack of appetite for people switching energy, but it was starting to improve somewhat. And I think stories like this actually just highlight even further. People go, well, what am I doing? Why am I not switching elsewhere? Mm. And I think the government has Ofgem has a switching sort of service now. We've been pretty successful. I was reading about that yesterday. But I think more people are sort of aware of switching.
I mean, to lose 300,000 customers when you've got millions perhaps doesn't sound extraordinary, but I just don't know that they're ever going to get any of those back again. Because once you switch, most people, when they're switching at the moment, are switching to the small suppliers. I think they've got about 1 in 10 energy customers now, which is huge. And a few of them have just ballooned over the last couple of years. And it's because they, in general, offer as good or better customer service. OVO's doing very well. First Utility had teething problems, but it's generally doing okay as well. People are taking a punt on the smaller suppliers and finding that their bills are going down and that they're not ending up with the same sorts of problems that they were getting. I find it hard to imagine that trend reversing and people saying, actually, do you know what, I miss NPower of British Gas.
Indeed. Well, we're going to stick with the complaining theme and a story that's got us all rather hot and bothered this week, and that's the revelation that airport shops are doing, well, something rather sneaky with VAT. Now, hands up who thought you had to show your boarding pass when buying that last-minute sun cream or perhaps an extra pair of swimming trunks. Well, I certainly did, and I am not alone.
I just assumed it was obligatory and it was a legal requirement and didn't ask any other questions.
Well, I feel, very ripped off. The audacity, I can't believe they've been doing it for so many years.
So not so, says HMRC. A spokesman for HM Revenue and Customers said there is nothing in VAT law to require the production of a boarding pass to purchase goods in airport shops. But without such evidence, the supply cannot be zero rated as an export. So why are stores doing it? So they can pocket the 20% VAT on goods they sell to travellers going outside the EU, a cut that the Treasury is telling them to pass on to us. And they are making millions from it. Here's Martin Lewis from Money Saving Expert.
What they tend to argue is that they do a global pricing discount. In other words, they factor in the money they get back and reduce prices for everybody across the board, which is a palpable load of baloney.
A palpable load of baloney. Lee, Rachel, remind us a little bit. Let's go right to the start. How the VAT system that we're talking about here actually works at airports.
So in theory, how it should work is anything that you buy in an airport when you're due to fly outside of the European Union should be treated as an export, and thus isn't subject to VAT at 20%. However, what we're finding out is that in practice, you're not getting any money off at all, but someone is, and it's the retailers.
And which retailers are we talking about here? Who are the culprits?
Boots, WH Smith, Dixon's are the big ones that seem to be doing this. I think, actually, I didn't realise that you didn't have to show your boarding pass, by the way. I'll hold my hands up and thought, you're at an airport.
Yeah.
And you kind of, when you get told to do something at an airport, you kind of do it because you don't want to sort of get in trouble.
There are some things you have to show your boarding pass date for, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's alcohol and tobacco. Because
so it's an extension of that, I thought.
Yeah, exactly. So I always thought about it because in the last couple of years, duty-free at the airport doesn't really seem particularly cheaper anymore. I don't know. Nothing seems to... I never go, wow, God, you know, there's a bottle of champagne there. It's the same price as it probably is if it's on offer in Tesco or whatnot. But, there are some items that, you know, stores don't have to do this on. But on certain stuff, you know, they should really be passing on the benefit onto customers. And the 20% off of certain big-ticket products can be, you know... Quite a
well, you give
saving.
An example here, a Burberry check cashmere scarf, which I'm sure would look lovely on you, Lee, that costs £335 on the high street, priced at £279 at the airport. That is not bad, is it?
That's not bad at all.
But we're not getting that.
But Burberry seem to be one of the stores that are in airports that are doing things right because they're showing a price, what it would be sort of in a high street shop with the VAT on, and then they're also showing the price. If you just show your boarding pass, you're going to get this discount on it if you're flying outside of the EU. So I don't know how much Burberry sells at airports, you know, compared to sort of Boots and WH Smith and Dixon's, because...
Dixon's, you can buy an iPad, and the savings there are about £120.
Yeah, so it's one of those things, and it's a bugbear of people. Now that people know, I can just imagine what it's like working in some of these shops in the bigger airports across the country, because people are just going to be going, no, I'm not showing my boarding passes, I don't have to. But in certain circumstances, as you rightly say, they do. So it'd be interesting what it's like.
This is really sneaky, isn't it? This is really sneaky. Are we likely to see, the Treasury's telling them to pass on that saving to us, are we likely to see that happen, Rachel?
It's just that it was in plain sight, isn't it? It really feels like we've been mugged. And I think, I mean, if the pressure stays on, if we continue to write about it, if people continue to get angry, then they must backtrack and start. I don't think we're going to see refunds on what we've been ripped off on so far. But certainly they should start passing on the savings.
How have they been reacting? Boots, Dixon's, WH Smith, have they said anything?
I think they've been relatively sort of quiet. I think they realise that they've been caught out. And I don't know if there are any plans. I haven't really seen any of the big bosses come out and say, hey, look, we've been doing this. Now we're going to start, you know, actually showing two prices at the airport. I haven't seen an awful lot about it.
I did my own price comparisons about a year ago, because I'm a geek, comparing... inside the terminal and then outside. Boots was exactly the same, which actually should have cottoned on that it should have been less because of the VAT thing. But Smith's just charges you, if you compare the online price or even a sort of the usual high street price with what you're being charged in the airport. I mean, I know that that's how they make money and sort of how they've improved their revenues the last couple of years. They've been doing this sort of pricing a lot more, but it was something like £3 to buy 12 envelopes in Smith's in the airport, and you're absolutely beholden to them, because if you're an idiot like me who decides to send their post once they've already gone through the terminal, you have to pay that. And they know it.
I think it's not just airports as well with WH Smith. If you ever go to a WH Smith in a train station,
yes.
Wow. I mean, you want a bottle of water and you're talking £2.50. And you're sort of thinking, well, hold on a minute.
Is this included in one of the 66 million complaints?
Well, yeah, because about 6.6 million of them from me. But I mean, it's one of those things, WH Smith. It obviously, a few years ago, wasn't doing as great as it once was because it's one of those sort of jack of all trade shops. Mm-hmm. It's got lots of stuff going on
like
in there.
Like Woolies a bit.
A bit like Woolies, yeah. But I think it's done very well in these airport spaces. You know, as Rachel said, people get caught out and at the last minute need to buy something. And then you
we
go
all
to
need
WSB
to send letters.
And, yeah, we all need to send, got to
on
send my bills. I forgot, you know, if I forgot to pay a bill or not. But at the airport, I just think people, it's hard for people to price compare when they're at the airport. And they instantly probably think, it's that weird logic. You go, well, it's at the airport, so it must be cheaper. But as this whole thing that's blown up shows...
Yeah, should we just accept it's not cheaper? And then just move on.
Yeah, I think so. And unless you're big ticket items, like something like a Burberry scarf, then perhaps, but... Yeah.
If you're going to accept it's not cheaper, then at least make sure that they're not profiting either. But good also, point. I fear that someone like Smiths, who does variable pricing anyway, if they're told then to pass on these 20% price cut to their customers, what's to stop them just putting up their prices slightly higher at airports and then taking off the 20% again?
Now, of course, you're hearing Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Also in the studio, Lee Boyce from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. Coming up, another unexpected rise in unemployment as new figures show the gap in incomes between Britain's richest and poorest appears to be growing.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost, making the pound in your pocket go that little bit further.
A very warm welcome. Now, there's been another unexpected rise in unemployment, the second quarter in a row that the figure has increased. We found out earlier this week that the number out of work went up by 25,000 between April and June, but average earnings increased by 2.4%. These people, though, that we spoke to, well, they say that they've not felt that benefit.
Wages haven't gone up in my particular work. And I think everything else has gone up, especially the good things, like going out.
Being a teacher, it's not the most highest paid jobs out there, so it's tough.
It's going slowly, working its way up. Not quick enough for me.
Well, despite the rise, David Freeman from the Office for National Statistics says we shouldn't draw too many conclusions from the figures.
What we have seen is that employment itself, although it's fallen that last couple of months, it's still at very close to its record level, 73.4% employment rate, over 30 million people in employment. And that's above where we were pre-downturn in both employment in level and rate.
So firstly, Lee, what do you make of these figures, unemployment? Do you agree with David Freeman, shouldn't be too worried yet?
Well, he's going to say that, isn't he, really, I think. The thing is, I mean, George Osborne's obviously, you know, and Conservatives have got back into power in April, and a lot of it has been on people that have voted because of the strength of the economy and, you know, there's more jobs. But these sort of figures are showing, oh, actually, hold on a minute, you know, it's gone down 25,000. It's not a huge drop. I mean, let's face it, but 30 million in employment. But it still doesn't bode great reading for the government if people are getting out of work.
Certainly not, though. Average earnings increased 2.4%. What do both these figures tell us about the state of the British economy more generally, perhaps, Rachel?
Within the context of low inflation, I mean, that's pretty good. If you're seeing your wages going up 2.4%, but inflation is at zero, that's a significant improvement to your finances. But what this report from Aviva that we are looking at this week shows is that there's just huge disparity between, you know, some people are seeing significant improvements to their finances, others are struggling even more than they were.
We spoke to Louise Colley from Aviva. Those figures that you're talking about showing that the gap in income between Britain's richest and poorest families appears to be growing. Take-home pay at a three-year high. Worst off, though, seems to be single parents who've actually seen theirs fall. Now, a typical family's monthly income after tax in May was £2,100, the highest since March 2012.
We are starting to be concerned, really, around single families. And when we talk about single families there, this also includes families that we have divorced or separated or even widowed. So essentially they are single parents looking after children. We're starting to see a greater divide in terms of income inequality. We've seen this time round in particular that for that segment, we've seen that their income has dropped by around £99 a month. Now, if you total that up, it's essentially just over £1,100, which is roughly what they're receiving as a monthly income. So we've seen a drop, which is quite significant. And what we've got to think about the consequence of that then is that for that particular segment, they don't, as we've seen through our report, traditionally have savings to fall back on. So we do worry about their financial viability and how they can get by over time. And will this be a trend that we see in the next report as well?
So tell us a little bit more, Rachel, that you were looking at this as well, this gap in incomes. What does it show?
Well, just what we've been seeing for a while now, that it's poorer families who are struggling even more than they were. Richer families are seeing themselves better off. And the fear is that this is a trend that will continue as the benefit caps, we've already got some, but they're going to become more stringent. It was hoped by the Chancellor, should be offset by the living wage, which sort of starts to creep in up until 2020. But there was a lot of number crunching around the budget that suggested that the increase in wages due to the increase in the high living wage will not be offset by the decrease in benefits that families currently benefit from.
It really looked into the different types of families as well. So couples with plans to have children will be the better off. What it also found as well, typical family is using income windfalls to save more, apparently, with the amount put aside each month rising to a record £113 from £99 in November last year. The typical savings pot now stands at £3,116, according to Aviva. Now that's good news, is it not?
That's encouraging. I mean, that sort of level of savings is very encouraging, especially if, as predicted, you know, early next year there is a base rate rise and people start finding finances not quite as good as what they have been in the last few years. But what it doesn't break down is, or it does actually, no, it says that, I think this is the more worrying statistic, is that a quarter of families have not saved anything in the last six months. So those figures are going to be heavily skewed by people with really big pots. So sometimes you have to take these reports with a little bit of a pinch of salt.
Again, which shows the split, though, in the...
It shows a massive split. So I'm going to predict the people that haven't... The families that haven't saved in the last 6 months are the same sort of households that are struggling on lower wages, as highlighted in this report. And, you know, at the end of the day, it is important to have a nest egg, but... Some people, it's just not doable. You've got a family, you've got young kids, you've got bills to pay for. It's hard sometimes to put that money aside, but, you know, if you can and save it for a rainy day, it's an ideal thing to do.
Well, Lee, we're going to stick with saving and savers being enticed to put their money into handfuls of deals that promise to pay more when the Bank of England base rate goes up. An increase is finally on the cards, with the bank warning it could come early next year or through to spring next year. We shall see, although precise date is anyone's guess, to be honest. But even if this does, and when this happens, there'll be no guarantee increases will be passed on to savers. Lee, it's been a rough old time for savers of late. Finally, perhaps some green shoots here?
It has been a rough time. I would say in the last couple of months, things have got slightly better. There's been a lot of better fixed rate deals. There's been a new Best Buy Easy Access account. But there are a couple of these accounts that are linked to potential interest rate changes. And actually, the best one is this one from Halifax, which is an 18-month tracker bond. It pays 1.93%, which is actually quite a good rate at the moment compared to others that are in our Best Buy tables. But what will happen is, if there is an interest rate rise in the coming months or early next year, it's actually linked to base rate. So it pays 1.43 percentage points more than base rate. So if it went up to 0.75%, which is the predictions it's going to nudge up fairly slowly, your rate automatically goes up to 2.18%. Now, if it goes up even higher during those 18 months, you're going to be quids in, really, because I can't see many other accounts that are going to offer that sort of short-term rate that comes with a monthly income. And monthly income accounts are very popular with our readers, because you put your money in and you're guaranteed a certain amount of money to come into your account each month that you live off. Now, there's been a real
neglect in these types of accounts in recent years. There's not actually as many as there once was, and it's a bit of a pain in the neck, particularly for pensioners. Pensioners tend to use them quite a bit. So this account's quite good. And if you do think that interest rates are going to rise in the next 18 months, it's probably a fairly good deal. And it's on the high street as well. So
not for everyone, though, is it, though?
It's not for everyone. You know, some people will prefer just to go, look, there's a two-year fixed rate at 2 point whatever percent it is at the moment, and we'll take that instead. But it's one of those things. There's a lot of people, a lot of our readers, that like to think they know when base rate's going to go up. No one really knows. But if you want to play the game, if you want to feel like you are somehow beating the system by getting an account that's linked to base rate, then this is one for you.
Go on, I want your predictions, though. Lee, Rachel?
I think early next year.
What? Give a month.
March.
May.
This is exciting.
I know.
Are you going to play this back as a clip at some
Annie,
point?
Yeah. Annie, what do you reckon?
I'm going to go for June.
All right. Rachel?
The one that was in between.
April.
April, there we go.
The Evening Show with Simon Rose. Getting to the heart of the issues that matter.
Share Radio's Evening Show features business people spilling the beans about their careers and offering advice to those who wish to emulate them. We look at the latest books and talk to a range of economists who bring a fresh perspective to the issues of the day. We also turn our magnifying glass on the world of politics and touch on technology and even movies. The Evening Show, every weekday from 6 to 9 on Share Radio.
Don't hold us to that. What's in it, though? What can we win? Just the pride of predicting when the Bank of England's base rate is going to go up.
The
fun and games here on consuming issues. You're listening to Share Radio. I'm Georgie Frost with you until 1 o'clock this afternoon on digital, online and through the Share Radio mobile app, making the pound in your pocket go a little bit further. The team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, are in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up. And today I'm joined by Rachel Rickard-Strauss and Lee Boyce. And coming up, the couple who face losing their home after being missold the scam savings plans. But first, sticking with mis-selling, and a brand new mis-selling scandal could see customers pocket a £33 billion windfall. Yes, just as the demand for PPI, or Payment Protection Insurance compensation, looked like it was finally starting to wind down a little bit, an even greater mis-selling scandal threatens to engulf Britain's biggest bank. So what have they done wrong this time? And how do you go about getting compensation if you're affected? Rachel, first of all, let's rewind. What is this new scandal? It's different, isn't it, from PPI, but related?
It is. It's just the latest twist, really. So it has emerged that not only were people charged for PPI, whether they needed it or not in some cases, but also they were paying commission to banks or third parties who were selling them the PPI. The question is whether this is fair and whether people knew about it.
How did it all come out?
So there was a case, it was about a couple of years ago now, that went as far as the Supreme Court. It was a woman who was sold PPI. That was fine. She knew that she was buying it. It was a decade ago. But what she didn't realise was that of the, it was £5,780 that she paid for PPI, 71.8% of that was commission. In the paperwork,
to who?
That,
who got that?
So it was a third party, and also the bank from whom she bought the PPI took a chunk. She did know that she was paying commission. Well, I don't know whether she read the small print, but she was given that information in the small print. But she didn't know, one, who was receiving the commission, and two, she had no idea that 71.8% was paid out in commission. And that kind of changes things a bit. You know, if you're happy to pay for a fee, it really changes the nature of whether you think you're getting value for money or not when you find out that most of it's going to a third party. So the court ruled that it was unfair. And then the question is, well, if she's been told that, does that set a precedent? Have the court set a precedent here? If they have, then it's estimated that if this same ruling is applied across the industry, banks and other providers could end up paying £33 billion. So they are all quite nervous now to find out how this ruling will be interpreted. The FCA is looking into it at the moment to try to decide what it's going to do next and what the implications are.
Well, in an indication of just how nervous they are, like you said, the Britain's big four lenders all telling shareholders how worried they are. Now, Barclays, HSBC, Royal Bank of Scotland, Lloyds all mentioned the court case in their latest financial results. HSBC, said there is a high degree of uncertainty as to the eventual cost of redress, while RBS, Lloyds and Barclays warn the impact could be, quote, material. So, goodness me, this could run into billions more, Lee.
It really could. So I can't get my head around the commission. 71.8% commission.
Give us an idea of
that's just like a feeding frenzy for firms that obviously have sold this PPI. And they must have just been laughing at this. I've never seen a commission charge like that. I mean, that is absolutely outrageous. I can't quite believe that. But the figure is...
But the fact it's happened means it may not be like a one-off.
It's not an isolated... You know, I'm going to predict this is not an isolated case, no. And this is why banks are starting to panic. And a £33 billion, you know, potential windfall is going to be a lot. And, of course, it helps prop up the economy a little bit more because that money's going to go into things like, you know, we've seen new car sales in the last couple of years, boom, largely because people are getting PPA payouts.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, let's buy a new car. So it's going to be good for the economy. But what also could emerge is a rise in more spam text messages, spam phone calls. Those sort of things could be on the rise again. You know, there's this £33 billion mis-selling scandal. Could you be affected type thing?
And even people who've been rejected in the past for PPI...
Could go for it again.
Could go again on the grounds of...
because the commission might have been eye-watering, like 71.8%.
Well, I think the jury's out as to whether the economy will benefit. Mark Garnier, certainly Conservative member of the Commons Treasury Select Committee, said another huge compensation bill would damage the economy with how much they've... So a bit of a grey area, I think it depends. And actually, as we've seen in a previous thing that we were discussing about with savings... more people are putting money aside for savings. So maybe with base rates going up, it will encourage people to put, if they do get any of this money, into a savings account. Who knows, Lee, your face is going, no way. New car all
holidays.
The way. Although don't buy at airports. Rachel?
Banks have been campaigning, lobbying for a while now to stop the PPI payouts because they think it creates too much. Bless them.
Or at least put a timescale on it,
A timescale so that after, I mean, it's been 6 years now, they want to sort of call time on it because
I'll
they think...
They do.
bless them, they say it creates too much uncertainty and it's very hard for them all to move on. And now they're just about to be whacked with this one, it looks like.
Repercussions to the financial industry. This is one product we're talking about. This is PPI commission. This could go so far. When will we know results of the decision?
I think next month the FCA will say what it plans to do. But... just as you say, some indication banks are really worried about it. And it means that all these complaints that they thought that they dealt with, they're going to have to go over all over again. I mean, not just are you talking about paying out compensation to people, but if you just think about the manpower to go through all of these, what are often very complicated sales and involving two, three parties, as we see, there are middlemen, all sorts of things involved, and working out culpability there, and with the banks resisting it at the same time, so that's going to create more friction. If the FCA decides that this case sets precedent, precedence is going to be huge.
Lee?
I was going to say, I read a story this morning which said the report next month from the FCA is also going to potentially put a time limit on the amount of time people have got to claim PPI at the end of next year. So it could be quite quick. If they put a limit on it, it could be end of next year.
So I imagine we'll be discussing this, though, in a month's time. From one mis-selling story to another, devastating for one couple who face losing their home, even though they're not behind on their mortgage. Now, pensioners Richard and Rita Kaufman will have their home repossessed where they've lived for 15 years after being sucked into a dodgy investment scam. Despite the Financial Ombudsman Service siding with the couple, they've said the scam they're in is so complex, so glad I've got you two here to explain it all. Nothing can be done to help them. The whole mis-selling scandal experience has has left them £376,000 in debt. Also, your editor Simon Lambert says what this does is it shows the reckless plunge into mortgage mania that just before the financial crisis that still hangs over Britain. So give us a bit of background to this. Lee, if you would, they were duped into investing in a savings plan that led them into remortgaging their home. Or, Rachel, would you rather take this on? Because this is rather complex, isn't it?
The reason why it seems so complicated and unfathomable is because it is unfathomable that this could ever happen. I mean, it's right that it seems so extraordinary. The numbers are insane. There's a couple, they're looking to sort of wind down, thinking about retirement. It's precisely at that point that you start to pay off your debts and... you know, put your finances into order so that you know what you're retiring on. Instead, they went to a financial advisor.
A decade ago, was this?
Yes, this was a decade ago. They went to a financial advisor who sold them all sorts of different strange financial products. The most dramatic of all is that they encouraged them to take out debt to invest. Which, I mean, you shouldn't do in the best of times, but when you're thinking about retiring, is the poorest advice that you could imagine. I looked at the comments on the story, and lots of people are, although sympathetic to this couple because they're losing their home, say, well, what were you thinking? But as Simon said, in that context, when people were sort of just giving away money, encouraging people to take out much more than they need to overstretch the whole time. And when this is coming from figures of authority, you know, financial advisors who you trust, if you're not that confident about your own finances, and someone with authority says with enough conviction, this will help you out, this will ensure that, you know, you have enough to retire on and you get the quality of life that you'd like for the next few decades, then I can understand why they listen to it.
So what's next for the couple then? They've got no help, is that right?
They're certainly going to get kicked out of their home
next Thursday, isn't it?
Pretty quickly. And it's such a huge shame. You know, a lot of this stuff was rife, you know, a decade ago, good old times before a lot of people learnt a lesson during the, you know, financial crisis and realised, you know, all things have to come to an end occasionally. And if something's too good to be true, which, reading the details of this case, this the products that they were taking out was going to cover their mortgage, which was like £1,600 a month, and also give them £600-700 a month to live off. I mean, instantly I'm thinking that it sounds far too good. And then, of course, you know, the financial crisis happened, a lot of people got their fingers burnt, and unfortunately some people get their fingers burnt more than others. And even years after, you know, the recession, we're still reading stories like this of people that, you know, they got a payout. I think it was £150,000, but it was still far short of what they've borrowed. And they owe money, you know, to this firm, which is now government owned, because a lot of these sort of investments got clubbed into this one sort of, you know, general thing that people get chased up for the debt and whatnot. And basically, there's not an awful lot they can do.
Can't they go to the person that misadvised them?
I actually think...
What happens to someone if it gives bad advice?
I think the guy that advised them passed away. Am I right?
Yeah, he did.
I think he's passed away, yeah.
I mean, that you can get recourse through the financial services compensation scheme, and I think they maybe... they did a bit, but there are so many different things that they were sold, and they've got compensation from some and not from others. The real body who could offer some kind of mercy now is UKAR, which is the government or state-owned body that took over all the bad debt from Northern Rock and Bradford and Bingley when things went wrong. It's their job to get back as much of the debt that's owed to the state as possible. They could show mercy in this case.
James Coney, actually, the Money Mail editor, had a column saying, George Osborne, you are the only person now that can stop you know, these people being kicked out of their home. So it'd be interesting, you know, stay tuned for next week's Money Mail, because you never know. You know, maybe George Osborne will contact Money Mail directly. You never know.
We shall see on that one. In more general terms, though, some tips you do mention here on the website, how to avoid mis-selling. Can you just give us a couple? What should you do?
Well, the first one is what I said just now. If it sounds too good to be true, it's probably going to be too good to be true. You know, the person that's offering you the advice, you've got to make sure that they've got the correct qualifications and that they're FCA, you know, registered. And are you taking on too much risk? You know, they took on far too much risk. They were borrowing money on money on money. You know, and unfortunately, they've put their house at risk. They've been convinced to put their money into it, and they shouldn't have done. And, you know, am I borrowing money to do this? Just that, you know, you shouldn't be borrowing money to then invest. You should be investing. It should be money that you've got saved away, not money that you're having to borrow from somewhere to put into it.
Let's turn our attention away from that and on to our next story. We bring you a very special report.
The anxious days and weeks through which we have all passed are over. The great adventure has begun. The final chapter in the history of the Second World War is being written.
Hello, skipper. Hello, navigator. Half a minute to go. Okay, keep weaving. Bomb doors open. Hello, bombardier. Okay, when you are. Bomb doors open. Bomb doors open, bombardier.
Any excuse to play something like that, but this kind of early radio and radar technology also used as a vital tool to provide an early warning system for incoming German attacks throughout World War II. But now it emerges, a wartime radar mast has been used for creaming millions of pounds off our pensions. Seems a little far-fetched, but the team from This Is Money have discovered that a 360-foot RAF radar metal tower in the hamlet of Dunkirk in Kent is sporting large satellite dishes used by so-called high-frequency traders to send high-speed signals about the latest share deals to other transmitters around the country. They make their money by benefiting on that fraction of a second, milliseconds we're talking here, between an order being placed and it being fulfilled in order to jump in and buy those shares first. Sounds like something out of a Michael Lewis book, probably, because it is, for anyone who's read Flash Boys. Lee, Rachel, what on earth is going on here?
This is insane, really. So high-frequency traders, they make money, tiny, tiny bits of money, but let me tell you, it all adds up through these deals. The way it works is, say I want to buy a load of shares in something, or more probable, say a pension fund wants to buy shares in something, it will put the order out to the stock exchange. And then depending on who else wants to buy or sell these shares, that will determine the price that I'll be able to buy at. But then along comes one of these high-frequency trading firms, and they will buy up the shares straight away and then sell them back on to me. Because they've bought up the shares, the price will increase because there's more competition in the market. And so they will sell to me at an ever so slightly higher price than I would have got had they not meddled in the first place. And while we're talking about fractions of pennies,
like you said, it all adds up.
If you're buying a lot, then it certainly adds up. And it's sort of hard to quantify just what sort of an impact it's having, because it's we're talking about fractions of seconds and fractions of pennies.
This is legal, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly Michael Lewis in his book Flash Boys drew attention to this phenomenon, and there's been a lot more scrutiny of that marketplace. But I think partly because it's just so complicated. I mean, it's taken a little while for the regulators to catch up with all of this.
But what about the Hound of Hounslow?
I'd forgotten about him.
One trader from Middlesex, after he was accused of being behind illegal trading which led to a stock market crash. This is how we've probably heard of something called flash trading without really realising it.
It's highly complicated, and guys like that manage to do it must be really quite intelligent.
Fast
fingers and fast eyes. How do you get all these deals like going? I'd actually quite like to spend the day with them to see how these things go.
Well, it would be great though if you could find out who they are, because the problem is, well, you can't really. It's all very murky world, isn't there, of who these people are that are doing it.
Which normally no one really cares about, but then when you've got this World War II mast that suddenly you've got massive companies interested in, that you can't work out who the companies are or who they're owned by, and they're offshore, and they're, you know, then it sort of becomes a lot more interesting to people.
Well worth a read, both Flash Boys and Holly Black's article, The Special Investigation, How Shadowy High-Tech Traders Are Using This World War II Radio Mast to Cream Billions Off Our Pensions. Thank you very much to Lee, to Rachel from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. You're listening to Consuming Issues.
Share Radio.